Hey there, ready to dive into some serious brain food?
Always up for a mental feast.
Today we're tackling Aristotle's Metaphysics.
Ah, Aristotle.
Book 12, to be exact.
Excellent choice.
You wanted to explore this idea of substance.
Right.
And how it shapes Aristotle's view of the universe.
It's a big one for sure.
Plus, we'll unravel his thoughts on change.
Hmm.
That whole first mover concept.
Okay.
And whether he thought there was one universe or many. Buckle up. Things are about to get pretty meta.
What I find really cool about Aristotle is how he starts with the world we all know, the stuff we can see and touch,
right,
and uses that to build up a whole picture of reality.
Okay, so he's not just floating in some abstract philosophical space. He's grounding his ideas in reality, right?
Exactly. In fact, he kicks off book 12 by saying,
let's hear it.
The subject of our inquiry is substance.
Okay.
Because for him, substance is the foundation of everything.
Hold on. Substance?
Yeah.
What exactly is that in Aristotle speak?
It's like the core essence of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
What makes it that thing and not something else? Imagine a cookie cutter.
Okay.
It gives shape to the dough.
Right.
Right?
Sure.
The cookie cutter is like the form, the substance, and the dough is the matter.
So the substance of a tree is what makes it a tree.
Exactly.
Not a rock or a cloud.
That's it.
Okay, I'm starting to see the the picture.
Yeah.
But he talks about three kinds of substance, right?
He does. First up, sensible substance.
Sensible substance.
That's anything we perceive with our senses, like the chair you're sitting on, the birds chirping outside.
Yeah.
Those are sensible substances.
Makes sense. So everything I can see, smell, touch, taste.
Yep.
That's all sensible substance.
You got it. And within that, he makes another distinction.
Okay.
Some sensible substances are eternal, like the stars and planets.
Okay.
While others are perishable.
Right.
Like, well, us humans.
Uh-oh.
We come and go, but those celestial bodies keep on shining.
Whoa. So even within the things we can perceive, there's a hierarchy of permanence. That's pretty deep.
It is.
What about the other kinds of substance?
Right. So the second type is immovable substance.
Immovable substance.
Think of it as existing separately from the world of senses.
Okay.
Some scholars link this to Plato's forms.
Uh-huh.
Those perfect, unchanging concepts.
Right. Yeah.
That exist in a realm beyond our direct experience.
Mm. So it's like this substance is more of an idea, a concept.
You're getting it.
Like the perfect form of justice or beauty.
You're on the right track.
Okay.
It's a bit mind-bending for sure.
Yeah, a bit.
And then there's a third kind of substance.
Okay.
The kind that blends matter and form, like you and me.
Uh-huh.
We are individual unique beings.
Right.
But we are also composed of physical matter.
Yeah.
And shaped by our form.
Okay, so the over there is sensible substance.
Yes.
The eternal stars are.
Yeah.
Whatever that other category was.
Immovable.
Right. Immovable. And I'm a combo platter, a little bit of both worlds. This is making me think about how, even though we experience the world through our senses, there might be a whole other level of reality beyond our immediate grasp.
It's a question that has fascinated philosophers for centuries. Now, you might be wondering how all this relates to Aristotle's predecessors.
Yeah, good point.
Thinkers like Thales, Anaximander.
Yeah.
They were all about finding one fundamental thing, like water or air, that everything else came from.
Okay.
But Aristotle...
Is a man buying it?
Not quite.
All right.
He felt they were overlooking the importance of substance.
Mm.
It's not just about what something is made of. Mm. It's about its fundamental nature, its form, what makes it that thing.
Got it. Substance over stuff.
Exactly.
Okay, so we've got the building blocks of reality down. But the world is constantly changing, right?
It is.
How did Aristotle explain that constant state of flux?
He breaks down change into four types.
Okay, four types.
Generation and destruction, increase and diminution, alteration and motion.
Right.
But underpinning all of these changes is the concept of matter.
Matter.
Think of it like the potential for change, the raw material that can be shaped and reshaped.
Okay, so matter is like... the blank canvas before the painting happens, or the lump of clay before the sculptor gets to work.
Precisely.
Okay.
He gives the example of something changing from potentially white to actually white.
Okay.
The matter has the inherent possibility of becoming white.
Right.
And through the process of change, that possibility becomes a reality.
I see what you mean. So the matter itself isn't created or destroyed.
Right.
It just takes on different forms through the process of change.
Exactly.
But where did all this matter come from in the first place? Was there like a starting point? A big bang of matter?
That's a question Aristotle wrestled with, too. He even looked at other thinkers like Anaxagoras and Empedocles, who had their own ideas about the universe's initial state.
Okay.
They talked about a primordial altogether, where everything was mixed up.
Like a cosmic smoothie?
Something like that.
Yeah.
But Aristotle thought it was more accurate to say that all things were together, potentially.
Okay.
But not actually.
Okay. I'm trying to wrap my head around that.
It's tricky.
It's like the ingredients for the smoothie existed.
Yes.
But they weren't blended yet. There was a blueprint.
Right.
A set of possibilities waiting to unfold.
Exactly. Even in the beginning, there was a kind of order, a potential inherent within matter itself, waiting to be actualized.
Mind blown. This is making me think about how we talk about potential in people.
Uh-huh.
Like, someone has the potential to be a great artist or a leader.
Yeah.
Maybe Aristotle's saying that potential is woven into the fabric of the universe itself.
It's an intriguing connection.
Yeah.
And this leads us to another fascinating question.
Ooh, lay it on me.
If everything is in constant flux,
right,
is there anything that doesn't change?
Hmm.
Is there a bedrock of stability beneath all this becoming?
That's a great question. I'm all ears.
That bedrock of stability is what led Aristotle to explore the concept of causes and principles.
Causes and principles.
He believed there are three fundamental elements at play in the universe.
Ooh, three. I'm intrigued. Lay it on me.
He starts with two contrasting ideas.
Okay.
Form and privation.
Form and privation.
Think of it like a sculptor working with clay.
Gotcha.
The clay itself is the matter.
Mm-hmm.
The statue's shape is the form.
I see.
And the lack of that shape before the sculptor starts molding.
Right.
That's privation. Change happens when the clay takes on the form, replacing the formlessness.
Okay, I see. So in Aristotle's view, change isn't just random.
Nope.
It's a process of moving from a state of lack to a state of form.
Yeah.
That formless lump of clay is yearning to become a majestic statue.
That's a great way to put it. And the crucial point here is this.
What's that?
For Aristotle, neither matter nor form are created or destroyed.
Mm.
They are eternal and unchanging.
Whoa, hold on. If neither matter nor form have a beginning,
yeah,
wouldn't that mean there's an infinite chain of causes?
Right.
Like, what caused the matter?
Mm-hmm.
And what caused that cause? It just keeps going back forever, right?
Exactly. And that's a problem Aristotle wanted to solve.
I bet.
He argued that there must be an ultimate cause.
Right.
Something that exists eternally.
Right.
And doesn't rely on anything else for its existence. Otherwise, we get stuck in that infinite loop.
Ah. So he's searching for the ultimate first domino that set everything else in motion.
Yeah.
I'm starting to see where this is going.
Ah.
Is this where the unmovable mover comes in?
You got it.
Yeah.
That's Aristotle's big idea.
Right.
The unmovable mover, the first cause, the ultimate source of all movement and change in the universe.
Okay, let's dive into that. Convince me why this unmovable mover has to exist.
Well, picture this.
Okay.
If everything was perishable.
Uh-huh.
If everything could ultimately be destroyed,
right,
then eventually even movement and time would cease to exist.
Yeah.
Everything would just stop.
Okay.
But Aristotle argued that time must always have existed.
Because time is just time, right?
Right.
It's always been there.
Exactly. And if time is eternal,
right,
there must be something eternal causing it.
I see.
That eternal cause is the unmovable mover.
Okay.
The source of all motion, but itself unmoved.
Okay. That makes sense. Time and motion are fundamental.
They are.
So something eternal has to be driving them. Can't all just fizzle out, right?
Exactly.
But most creation stories I've heard talk about the universe emerging from chaos.
Yeah.
Or nothingness.
Yeah.
Aristotle is flipping the script.
Yeah, he is.
He's saying there's always been order.
Yeah.
And this unmovable mover is the force behind it all.
Yes.
But what's this unmovable mover like? Can we know anything about it?
Aristotle describes it as eternal.
Eternal.
Unmovable.
Unmovable.
Without size.
Okay.
Impassive and unchanging.
Unchanging. It's pure actuality.
Pure actuality.
Pure perfection.
Wow, that's quite a resume. But I'm still stuck on this idea of something unmovable causing all this movement.
Hmm.
It's like saying a statue can sculpt itself. How does that even work?
This is where it gets super interesting. Aristotle says the unmovable mover causes motion.
Okay.
By being the ultimate object of desire and thought.
So like a cosmic magnet, everything is drawn towards it.
Yes.
Even though it's not actively doing anything.
A perfect analogy.
Wow.
And get this.
What's that?
The unmovable mover's actuality.
Uh-huh.
Its essence.
Okay.
is pleasure.
Wait, pleasure? That doesn't sound very immovable.
I know, right? He links this to the pleasure we find in being awake, in perceiving the world, in thinking.
Okay.
These are all activities where we are most fully alive.
Right. Most fully ourselves. Mm. And he suggests that the unmovable mover experiences this kind of perfect pleasure eternally.
Okay, this is getting pretty trippy.
It is.
So we are all striving for this perfect eternal pleasure.
Yeah.
And that striving, that desire, is what sets the universe in motion.
That's the essence of it. But this brings us to a fascinating question.
Okay, what's that?
Is there only one unmovable mover?
Hmm.
Or could there be multiple sources of this perfect pleasure?
Okay.
Multiple forces driving the universe.
Multiple movers. I've heard of multiple universes, but this is a new one.
I know, right?
So is Aristotle saying there might be a whole bunch of these unmovable pleasure seekers out there?
Yeah.
Each responsible for a different part of the cosmos?
It's not as out there as it might sound.
Okay.
Aristotle doesn't give us a clear-cut answer.
Right.
But he does contrast his view with the theory of ideas.
Right.
Which, as you know, doesn't offer much concrete guidance on how many substances there might be. He suggests that we should look to what we can observe. Mm. To the heavens themselves.
Ah, okay.
For clues.
So instead of getting lost in abstract ideas,
right.
He's saying, let's look at the stars and see what they can tell us.
Exactly.
Cool.
Remember, Aristotle was a keen observer of the natural world. And when he looked at the stars and planets,
uh-huh.
He saw these eternal bodies in constant complex motion.
Yeah.
He wondered how those intricate movements could be explained.
It's not like everything in the sky is just moving in perfect circles.
Yeah.
I remember learning about retrograde motion in astronomy class.
Right.
Planets appearing to move backwards.
Uh-huh. Yes.
Pretty wild.
That's one example. To explain these seemingly erratic movements,
okay.
Astronomers had already started developing models involving multiple spheres,
okay.
Each rotating on a different axis. Aristotle drew on the work of Eudoxus and Callippus.
Eudoxus and Callippus.
Two astronomers who mapped out these celestial spheres.
So picture a bunch of invisible gears turning in the sky.
Yeah.
Each one influencing the movement of the planets.
Precisely. Eudoxus started with 27 spheres to explain the movements of the sun, moon, and planets. His student Callippus refined that model.
Right.
Adding more spheres to account for even more subtle variations in planetary motion.
Okay, so they were creating a really complex model of the universe.
Like
a giant celestial clockwork.
Yeah.
But how does this tie back to the unmovable movers?
Aristotle saw a connection between the movement of these celestial spheres and the concept of the unmovable mover.
I see.
He reasoned that each sphere must be moved by something.
Right.
Just like the outermost sphere, the sphere of the fixed stars, is moved by the first unmovable mover.
So each sphere has its own mini mover, its own little engine driving it.
You could say that. But to make the models work, they needed more than just spheres moving in one direction.
Hmm. They also needed something called counteracting spheres.
Counteracting spheres? What in the cosmos are those?
Imagine two gears turning in opposite directions.
Mm-hmm.
The movement of one is counteracted or balanced by the other. That's what these spheres did.
Ah, I see. They kept the movements of the planets from becoming chaotic.
Exactly.
Like a cosmic balancing act.
Exactly.
Wow.
They ensured that the combined effect of all the spheres produced the precise movements we observe in the heavens.
Okay.
And it turned out they needed a lot of them.
Okay, so how many unmovable movers are we talking about here? One for each sphere.
Callippus's model, which Aristotle seemed to favor, ended up with 55 spheres in total.
55? That's a lot of movers.
It is.
So is Aristotle actually suggesting there are at least 55 unmovable movers?
He doesn't say for sure.
Okay.
But it seems possible, each chilling out and enjoying their eternal pleasure while also keeping a specific celestial sphere spinning.
Haha, I love it. So instead of one single unmovable mover, we might be talking about a whole team of cosmic movers.
Wow.
Each responsible for a different aspect of the universe.
Okay, so multiple movers, multiple spheres, all working together to create this incredibly complex, beautiful, and ordered universe.
It is.
My brain is working overtime here, but I love where this is going.
Me too.
It's like Aristotle took that idea of perfect pleasure being the ultimate driver and scale it up to a cosmic level.
That's a great way to put it.
But he didn't stop there. right?
Nope.
Didn't he also connect these ideas to the concept of the divine?
He did indeed. And that connection adds another layer of depth to his whole view of the cosmos.
All right, let's talk gods and the cosmos. Always a fun topic.
It is.
What did Aristotle have to say about all that?
Well, he looked at the ancient tradition of seeing celestial bodies as gods. You know, like how the Greeks had Zeus and Hera up on Mount Olympus watching over everything.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the gods and their cosmic drama. But Aristotle wasn't exactly a mythology buff, was he?
Not quite, but he didn't completely dismiss those ancient ideas either.
Okay.
He suggested there might be a grain of truth in them.
Uh-huh.
What he called an inspired utterance.
So he was open to the idea that there was some wisdom in those old stories, that maybe those ancient people were onto something when they looked up at the stars and saw something divine.
Exactly. He saw a connection between those celestial movers, those sources of perfect pleasure, and the idea of a divine force shaping the universe.
I can see that.
That's right.
It's like those ancient myths were trying to grapple with the same questions. Aristotle was exploring questions about order, purpose, the ultimate source of everything.
Exactly.
And Aristotle took it a step further.
He did.
He suggested that the universe itself contains the good. It's not just that there's a separate divine entity imposing goodness from the outside.
Right.
Goodness is woven into the very fabric of reality. Okay, that's a big idea.
It is.
So it's not like Zeus is up there deciding what's good and what's bad.
Nope.
Goodness is baked into the system itself.
That's right.
He uses this great analogy of a well-ordered house to illustrate what he means.
Yes, he does.
Just like every part of a house has a function.
Uh-huh.
And all those functions work together to make the house a livable space.
Right.
So, too, does every part of the universe have a role to play in contributing to the overall good?
That's the idea.
I love that analogy.
Me too.
And so even things that seem random or pointless actually have a purpose.
Yes.
They contribute to the overall harmony. It's like even my messy desk.
Right.
Might be part of some cosmic plan.
He even suggests that seemingly random actions within the universe contribute to the good in some way.
That's a comforting thought.
It is.
But if the universe is this well-ordered house,
yeah,
and these celestial movers are like the architects,
right,
what about the ultimate mover,
the
first cause?
Yeah.
What's it focused on?
Good question.
What's its purpose?
That question takes us to what might be the most mind-blowing part of Aristotle's thinking.
Right, hit me.
The nature of divine thought.
All right, I am so ready for this. Tell me everything.
He starts by pointing out that we humans consider thought to be the most divine thing we experience.
Okay.
But if we apply that to the divine,
right,
it raises some tricky questions.
Like what?
Well, if the divine mind is thinking about nothing.
Yeah.
It's like it's asleep.
Mm.
Which doesn't seem very divine.
Yeah, if God's just taking an eternal nap, that's not very inspiring.
Right. And if the divine mind is thinking about something else, that means that something else is more important than the divine mind.
Right.
And that doesn't make sense either.
So either God's not thinking.
Yeah.
Or it's thinking about something even more divine. It's a real head scratcher.
Exactly.
Okay.
And if the divine mind is thinking about something, does it even matter what it's thinking about? Is it thinking about something good? Something bad.
Good point.
These were all questions Aristotle wrestled with.
This is making me think about all those Renaissance paintings of God surrounded by angels deep in thought.
Yeah, I see that.
But if Aristotle is right, what is God actually thinking about?
That's where Aristotle drops a real philosophical bombshell.
Okay, let's hear it.
He concludes that the divine mind must be thinking about itself.
Whoa.
Yeah.
So God's ultimate purpose is to just think about thinking.
That's it. He makes this point that knowledge, perception, and opinion, understanding, these are all directed outwards towards the world.
Right.
But the divine mind,
okay,
and the source of everything,
right,
doesn't have anything outside itself to think about.
So it has to turn inward.
Yeah.
Its thinking becomes a kind of self-reflection.
Exactly. And Aristotle says this is the highest form of thought, the most divine activity.
Okay. I think I'm starting to get it.
Good.
But this raises another question. If the divine mind is thinking about itself.
Yeah.
Is it thinking about something composite?
Uh-huh. Something made of parts.
Okay.
Because if so, wouldn't that mean its thoughts are changing as it moves from one part to another?
That's a really insightful question. And Aristotle anticipates it.
Of course he does.
He points out that anything without matter is indivisible.
So since the divine mind is pure thought.
Right.
pure form.
Yes.
It's not made up of parts.
Precisely. So its thought must be a single, unchanging act of self-contemplation.
Wow, that's heavy stuff. But I have to say, it's pretty amazing how Aristotle takes these seemingly simple questions about what things are made of,
yeah,
and what causes change, and he ends up with this mind-blowing vision of a universe driven by perfect pleasure.
It is mind-blowing.
And a divine mind contemplating itself.
It really is.
I have to say, this is one of the most mind-bending deep dives we've done yet.
I agree.
But I'm loving it.
Me too.
Yeah.
And there's still so much more to unpack.
Really? There's more.
We've talked about the structure of Aristotle's universe, right, the forces that shape it.
The divine mind.
Uh-huh.
But where do we fit into all of this?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering. We can't just be passive bystanders in this cosmic drama,
right? Not at all. And luckily, Aristotle had a lot to say about our place in the universe. But I think we need to take a little breather before we tackle that part of his philosophy.
All right, sounds good. We'll be back in a flash to explore what Aristotle's metaphysics means for us mere mortals living our very non-eternal, very messy lives down here on Earth. Welcome back.
Back again.
We've been on quite a mind trip with Aristotle.
Yeah.
Exploring his ideas about substance change and the movers behind the universe. Last we left off, you were explaining how goodness is built into the fabric of reality for Aristotle. Not like some external force, but woven into the very design of things.
It's a powerful idea, isn't it? And that brings us to where we fit into this grand scheme. Remember Aristotle's analogy of the well-ordered house?
I do.
Every part has a purpose, a role to play in making the house function as a whole. Well, he applies that same logic to the cosmos.
Okay, so if the universe is the house, are we like the furniture, or maybe the plumbing, hopefully not the garbage disposal?
Maybe a better comparison would be the inhabitants of the house.
Okay.
We humans,
right,
along with all the other living beings on Earth, have our own parts to play in this grand cosmic order.
But I have to admit, it feels a bit overwhelming.
It can.
Our lives seem so insignificant compared to the eternal dance of the celestial spheres and the divine mind pondering itself for all eternity.
I understand that feeling.
Yeah.
But remember what Aristotle said about seemingly random actions contributing to the overall good?
Yeah.
It's not just about the big flashy stuff.
Right.
Even the smallest actions can ripple out and have an impact on the universe.
Kind of like the butterfly effect.
Exactly.
A butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, and eventually we get a hurricane in Florida.
Exactly. We may not always grasp the full extent of our impact, but we are all interconnected, part of this intricate web of cause and effect.
Okay, I'm starting to see how even my little everyday choices could be part of something bigger. But if everything is ultimately ordered towards the good, as Aristotle suggests, what about all the bad stuff that happens in the world? War, famine, people tripping over their own feet. It doesn't exactly paint a rosy picture of a universe governed by goodness.
That's a question that has challenged philosophers for centuries. And Aristotle himself doesn't offer a simple answer.
Okay.
He acknowledges the existence of evil and suggests it might be a consequence of the limitations of matter.
So, like, matter itself is inherently imperfect.
Yes.
And that imperfection can manifest as bad stuff.
That's one way to look at it. He also hints that evil might be a privation.
Privation.
An absence of good rather than a thing in itself.
Ah, like darkness isn't a thing.
Right.
But just the absence of light.
Yeah, precisely. So evil might be seen as a kind of incompleteness.
Okay.
A deviation from the natural order that strives towards the good.
Okay, I'm following you. It's not that there's some evil force out there battling against the good.
Right.
It's more like evil is a gap, a void where goodness should be.
That's a good way to think about it.
But even if we accept that evil exists and that we have our roles to play in this grand scheme of things, it still feels a bit deterministic. Like our paths are already laid out for us. Where's the room for free will in Aristotle's universe?
That's a great question, and it's one that Aristotle himself grappled with.
I bet.
He certainly believed in a natural order, a set of laws that govern the universe, but he also recognized our capacity to make choices, to deliberate, and act according to our own reasoning.
So it's not a simple either.
Nope.
It's not fate versus free will.
Right. Aristotle saw human beings as rational animals, meaning we have the unique ability to understand the natural order and act in accordance with it. But that understanding doesn't take away our ability to make choices. In fact, it's that very capacity for reason that allows us to exercise free will.
So it's not just about blindly following a predetermined script. Yeah. It's more like understanding the rules of the game.
Yes.
And then making strategic choices within those rules.
Exactly.
We have agency.
We do.
We have the power to act.
I like that analogy. And this highlights the importance of ethics for Aristotle. He believed that living a virtuous life, a life guided by reason and aimed towards the good, was essential for human flourishing.
So it's not enough to just understand the universe.
Yeah.
We have to act on that understanding and choices that align with the good.
Yes. For Aristotle, knowledge without action is incomplete. And living virtuously is how we participate in this cosmic dance. So we contribute to the overall goodness of the universe.
Wow, this is heavy stuff.
It is.
But also incredibly inspiring. It's not just about understanding the universe.
What?
It's about living a good life,
yeah.
making good choices.
Exactly.
A lot of responsibility.
It is.
But also incredibly empowering.
Exactly. And this brings us to one of the most fundamental takeaways from Aristotle's metaphysics.
Okay, what's that?
The idea that the universe is intelligible.
Is it?
It can be understood through reason and observation.
Okay.
He was encouraging us to observe the world.
Right.
To ask questions.
Yeah.
To seek understanding.
So he's not just building a philosophical system in a vacuum.
Nope.
He's grounding it in the world we experience.
Yes.
Encouraging us to get curious and explore.
Precisely.
Right.
And that's what makes Aristotle so relevant today. His ideas aren't just abstract theories.
Right.
They offer a framework for engaging with the big questions about reality, purpose, and our place in the cosmos.
This deep dive has been a wild ride. We've gone from the basic building blocks of reality.
Yes, we have.
To the nature of divine thought.
That's right.
All while exploring what it means to be human in this ordered and purposeful universe.
It's been a fascinating journey. And although we've covered a lot of ground, there's always more to explore in Aristotle's work.
Absolutely. But before we wrap things up,
yeah.
I'd love to leave our listeners with a final thought to ponder.
Here's one.
Okay.
Aristotle developed his ideas over 2,000 years ago, based on the knowledge available at the time. How might modern scientific discoveries, things like the vastness of space, the evolution of life, and the fundamental laws of physics challenge or refine his view of an eternal and ordered cosmos?
Ooh, that's a good one. It's like taking Aristotle's framework and applying it to our current understanding of the universe.
Yeah.
Could his ideas still hold up, or would they need some major tweaking?
It's something for all of us to think about as we continue to explore these big questions about reality and our place within it.
That's a great note to end on. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Aristotle's metaphysics.
It's been a pleasure.
We hope you're leaving with a little more wonder.
Yes.
A little more curiosity.
Definitely.
A whole lot to think about. Until next time.
See you then.
Keep questioning, keep learning, and keep diving deep.